Mrs. Rose, reel two.
When you had got your sets for flying, you would go out to whichever of the taxi aircraft was going to take you on to your first job, and they would deliver you at the aerodrome, and you would then go to collect your aircraft. You would do your routine check on it, and you would take off and move it on to the next port of call. On the whole, particularly with the fighter aircraft in the south of England, they were fairly short hops, and the flying time would probably only be about 20 minutes, 25 minutes on each one. But the time it took you to collect it and deliver it would make quite a busy day of it. When you went into an aerodrome delivering an aircraft, you would always deliver it to flying control, and you would get a signature for it. You would then wait patiently either for the taxi aircraft to come, or you would go out and find the one that you were taking on. It all sounds quite a simple process, but the operations officer had a very busy time sorting out these different programs for 20-25 pilots, and having them the aircraft telephoned in and out. I mean, sometimes plans would be changed during this, and that was a very skilled operation indeed, to keep us all busy and to keep things moving and to move them as fast as they could, obviously. I mean, once they were on the list, then the big thing was to get them moved.
What did you think of your operations officer at Hamble?
Well, Hamble was an all-women's pool, and when I was first designated to them, I thought, well, now, I wonder about this. You know, what about all this number of women in... And, in fact, I found it was an extremely happy pool, that we all seemed to get on extraordinarily well. We'd got some interesting nationalities there. There was a girl from Chile, even, who came over to England. You've probably heard about Margot Dualdi, who came over to England with no English. And ATA accepted her on her flying, and one of her first cross-countries, she false-landed. And when she couldn't speak English, of course, she was promptly put in the local police station. And after ATA collected her, because it finally got through to them that she was missing, and they decided she must learn some English, and so they put her to work in the hangars, and she learned some very interesting English, and she really taught us all swear words that we'd never heard before. But she was a sweet person and great fun. We had a girl from the Argentine, we had one from Denmark, we had a Polish girl, we had, of course, Americans who came over and were first class and came over in quite large numbers before even the Americans came over, came into the war. Canadians, Australians, and for a pool of only, I can't remember what the total number was, you probably already know that, but it was smallish. I mean, there certainly weren't more than sort of 25 or 30 of us. It was a very interesting mix, and we did get on terribly well, and the operations officer was very much accepted as part of the team and as senior member of the team, because she had terrific responsibilities.
What about your commanding officer?
Oh, Margot was great. She was fine. A very straightforward, sensible person, and managed to keep a certain amount of necessary discipline without appearing to do so, which was very clever of her, because we were a pretty individual lot, and I think that was highly intelligent and quite clever.
Was there any sense of rivalry amongst you?
Oh, I certainly never thought of it. I don't think in the least bit. I think that if one reckoned that the operations officer wasn't giving one sort of interesting jobs, or you were desperate to have a new type and they hadn't thought of it yet, you'd sometimes say, well, the next time you've got whatever it is going, do think of me. But no, I don't think there was rivalry. I think we were all intent on doing what we thought was a useful job as best we could. I don't think it was a question of, you know, what we were clocking up, or certainly not in my sort of group. Not that there were individual groups. I don't think, obviously, one had good friends amongst them, ones that you saw after hours more than others, inevitably, because we didn't all live in the same place anyway. But it was a very loose community from that point of view.
Was there any sense of daring when it came to deciding whether or not to fly according to the weather conditions?
No, and that would have been heartily discouraged. In the first place, the CO had to feel that it was weather that was suitable for flying. In the second place, you had to make your own decision, and nobody would have admired you if you'd taken on risky things, because expensive aircraft, which we were very short of, were not to be played with.
What were your chief hazards?
Well, down at Hamble, if we were flying in that area at all, we had the barrage balloons at Southampton and Portsmouth. And weather was always a hazard, because one had got to be conscious of it all the time.
Were the aircraft themselves in any way dangerous?
Oh no, because one wouldn't have been flying them if they had been. Occasionally we thought we were taking old bags back to and sort of limping in, but I don't think they were really in a dangerous condition. I think some of them were reaching fairly near the end of their flying careers. But
did it worry you at all?
No.
Did you ever have any accidents?
One, which I'm not very proud of, and one only, and that was I was taking a swordfish down from Shifnal, and was due to take it to the south, to near Southampton, I think. And the engine cut going over the Wrekin, and I had to false land. And the fields round there all seemed to me extraordinarily small. And having chosen a field and doing as rough an approach as one obviously would if you hadn't got an engine, but heading into wind and aiming at this one, I didn't know that the field was slightly downhill, and instead of pulling up, because there were no brakes on this aircraft, one didn't stop, and I went through a hedge, and on the other side of a hedge there was a young lad ploughing. And to avoid him, I had to swerve hard to the left, whereupon the aircraft turned over, and a very angry woman got out of that aircraft. And because it had got secret equipment on it, I had to get the boy to mount guard on it while I went and telephoned. And then the RAF had to come in from Cosford and mount guard on it for the night, and this was a Saturday. And this was extraordinarily unpopular in the mess, because they had a dance on and two chaps had to miss the dance. However, on investigation, and they found that I wasn't responsible for this, and so they were very good about not taking any disciplinary action or anything else on my behalf. Happily, I found I'd got a brother-in-law at Cosford, and he bought two bicycles, and we cycled out for dinner, which was a very good way of spending a rotten Saturday afternoon. But that was the only accident I ever had in ATA, I'm thankful to say.
Were you hurt at all?
No, I wasn't. They checked on me when they got me back to Cosford, because Cosford was at the other women's pool, and the MO there had a look at me. No, apart from being angry,
what
I wasn't
about
hurt.
Psychological damage?
Well, again, I felt at the time that I hadn't really had any alternative, that it was impossible to know that this field was sloping downhill. If it had been sloping uphill, I should have been fine. Or if it had been on the level, I think I'd have made it. But it was one of those unfortunate things. And with any luck, the next engine wasn't going to cut. But it could... No, it didn't undermine one's confidence at all.
Had you received instruction on what to do in the eventuality of the engine cutting?
But your alternatives are very limited. I think that's why I've never taken to gliding.
Was it anything that worried you that an engine might cut again?
Well, I suppose it's always a worry, but you don't actually believe that it's going to happen until it does.
You mentioned that you were carrying secret equipment. Had you been told this?
Oh, yes. It was on the undercarriage. It was for locating ships, you know, the swordfish were used by the fleet Aeron. And, yes, one knew about it because it... And because, in case anything like this happened, that one wouldn't just abandon it.
So you were told before takeoff?
Oh, yes.
How frequently did that happen?
I can't really remember. I don't think very often. But it was part of routine. And it wouldn't have been memorable. So it wouldn't have put any extra strain on one.
Did you have to deliver priority aircraft?
Well, I don't know. How does one designate priority aircraft? I suppose the deliveries to the squadrons were always priority. And yes, we all did that. And I think we all felt... we were all happiest doing that, of course, because it was... Very often the squadrons were waiting for them and needing them. And so they would all have been very priority.
Did you ever feel there was pressure upon you?
No, more than any other job that one might have been doing during the war. And there was pressure on everybody.
What about navigation?
Well... You asked about lectures on the ground. That was one that we certainly had lectures on. And as we weren't allowed to use radio at all, it was one that you had to pay attention to. We had compasses, and that was it. So when you went into the Met Office in the morning, you were very keen to know what the winds were, and how strong they were likely to be, where you were going to, because this had a distinct bearing on where you'd land up. In a way, this was the way our flying had always been done. When I learnt to fly, this was the way you did it. And if worst come to worst, you've got jolly good railway lines, which are easy to see, and you can usually pick them out. And we always had our maps with us, of course.
Did you ever get lost?
Yes. I think most of us did from time to time. But, as I say, one could usually find a railway line or a group of trees in a specific shape, which would be the same shape on your map, were tremendously helpful, and you could usually pick something up and locate yourself. And with any luck, you weren't going to lose too much time on it. So that, although one got lost, one usually found oneself again.
Did you ever make any long trips up to Scotland?
Yes, I mean, one of the very early ones was when we were, a whole group of us were ferrying tiger moths up north, but we had frightfully bad weather that year, and we're having to put down at aerodromes. I mean, we were trying to get up there, and if the weather got too bad, we put down at the nearest aerodrome. And I seem to remember one tiger moth that I was taking to Scotland taking me about 3 days to get it there. But, I mean, normally, if one was flying to Scotland in a Spitfire or something, it didn't take very long. So that, you know, that wasn't a problem.
How easy was it to get home again?
Well, if there was a taxi aircraft coming, it was very easy. But from time to time, you were told to return by train or something of the sort. And when we were flying, we always took an overnight bag in case we were stuck out at an aerodrome. And there was one particular night that I still remember very vividly when I'd taken an aircraft to Barnstable in Devon and was told to catch the train back. And I caught the train from Barnstable to Exeter. Having arrived at Exeter, I had to wait for the express from Exeter to London. And I hadn't been able to have anything to eat that day, and because I'd been at work all day moving things. And when I got to Barnstable, the little train was going out fairly soon, and so hadn't stopped there for tea. So I'd literally had a sandwich and a piece of chocolate that I'd taken with me in the morning. And so I was jolly hungry by then. And the express didn't come in till 11:30. And it was just before Christmas, and it was a train for about 300, and it had got 750 troops on it. And the guard took pity on me and took me into his compartment, where there was about half a dozen chaps in there. And one of them, of blessed memory, had got a pack of sandwiches which he shared round, which I was very grateful for. We arrived in London at about 4:30 in the morning, whereupon I got across London with my parachute and my overnight bag, because we had to take a parachute everywhere with us, and caught the train back to Luton. And then, in fact, did report for work next day. And I can't remember what I was given, but that was rather the nastiest journey back that I ever had, because it was no chance of getting any sleep on that train at all, because I was sitting on my parachute. I mean, that was one of the good uses of a parachute, that it was something to sit on if there wasn't a seat. But on the whole, things worked much better than that.
How fit were you for flying duties if you were tired?
I have the feeling they probably kept me off the next day, but I do know that I reported in. So, I expect they would have thought exactly that.
What about finding overnight accommodation? How easy was that for a woman?
Oh, usually very easy. That the aerodrome to which you had delivered to would either put you up in the WAF's mess, or sometimes in the officer's mess, or if it hadn't got that sort of accommodation, they would get you a billet near. So there wasn't really ever a problem over that.
How well were you received at the various RAF bases that you flew to?
They were very good about it. I think amongst some of the younger ones, there was a great deal of jealousy over the variety of aircraft we were able to fly, because in the RAF they were very much trained up to fly one type, and the fact that we had such a variety on our logbooks could be a source of envy. But they were quite pleased to have us around, I think.
Were women pilots acceptable at that point?
Again, these are all sorts of questions which one wouldn't think of asking. I mean, at that time. These are questions which have come up very much more since women have been conscious of what they were doing. And seemed to be much more concerned and worried about acceptance or non-acceptance. It wasn't of concern to us at all as to whether we were accepted or not. We were doing a job of work and we were expected, and I personally was expecting to be accepted on perfectly equal terms. And I think it's like so many other things. If that is your approach to it, then that is the way it works.
ATA was a civilian organisation. How did the status of that fit in with working quite closely with the RAF?
Again, the accent wasn't on status. It was on usefulness. The fact that we wore a livery rather than the uniform, I don't think struck an awful lot of people. It was looked upon as the same sort of thing, that it happened to be more convenient to have us in some sort of livery that was easily accepted or easily identified, is what I'm looking for. But I don't think it really had any bearing on the work at all.
You mentioned the uniform. How adequate was this for flying and sitting around on RAF bases?
Well, our uniform was trousers and tunic, and we had jackets of varying types. I think most of us had our own, but we also had overalls that we could wear. I don't think we ever wore them very much, no. And then one had a skirt for wearing outside the job, as it were, when you wanted to. I mean, if one was going to London in uniform, one didn't wear trousers, one wore a strip skirt.
Were there any official rules as to the wearing of skirts and trousers?
No, they tried to have official rules about length of hair, but that didn't work too awfully well. And we weren't awfully good at saluting because we were never trained to do that. And one of the ways of getting around that, of course, was not to wear your hat, because you couldn't salute if you didn't wear that rather silly little hat, which was quite difficult to balance anyway. Looked quite smart, but if you hadn't got your hat on, you didn't salute, so that let you out.
And what was the attitude to you not wearing the hat?
I think there were occasions when certainly one CO would have preferred one to. And if you were wearing it outside, this was mainly on stations, and you were putting on flying helmets and those sorts of things on and off, so that, I mean, if you were flying a Spitfire, although you'd got the hood to put over, you took off and landed with the hood open, and so you needed to wear a helmet for that. And if you're taking things on and off your head the whole time, it was quite easy not to not wear a hat ostentatiously, but just not to have it on. So I don't think nobody... These are details of life which were not very important.
Was cold a problem?
Oh, it could be, yes. But we did all have our own flying jackets, and they helped very much. No, one did get very cold, and very often when you were waiting to be picked up by a taxi, you were waiting in a shed or something, and you did get jolly cold. Flying boots were absolutely essential, and one wore those for the greater part of the year, actually.
Were these issued to you?
Yes.
What about on your hands?
I think we probably had. Did we have issue gloves? I think we may have done. If not, we certainly had them. But I can't honestly now remember whether they were issue or not.
How adequately were you able to take meal breaks at a regular basis?
Oh, you didn't. I mean, that was not one of the things that you aimed at or felt was important. One reported for work having usually had some breakfast, and then it depended on where you were likely to be at lunchtime. Sometimes you took sandwiches, One always got a ration of chocolate, which made you very popular with nieces and nephews because you didn't always eat it. And when all sweets were rationed, if you happened to have a bar of chocolate, you were sure of a good welcome. But when you were waiting either to be picked up or for the next aircraft or something of the sort, you very often got a cup of hot sweet tea, and you learnt to drink it whichever way it was presented, out of good thick mugs or tin ones or anything else that was there. But during the day, you certainly didn't come down from one till two.
If you arrived at that time, would you be given a meal by the
hour? Oh, yes. Yes, yes. And sometimes that would be convenient and sometimes it wouldn't. But most of the RAF stations would have a sort of running lunch so that one could go in and have it fairly quickly. So if you were sure you weren't going to be picked up, then that was what happened. Someone took you in, you know. And that was fun.
What about in the evenings when you returned home? Did you have to prepare a meal?
Yes, because while I was down at Hamble, I had a small flat which was on the river, opposite the yacht club and next door to the Bugle, so it was very well placed. And we used to, Rosemary Rees, as she then was, Rosemary de Crowe, as she now is, and Philippa Booth, and she's now Philippa Bennett, as she then was, she's now Philippa Booth, whom I think you know you've talked to, and I'm sure you've seen both of them, haven't you? Lived in a cottage about just round the corner from me. And very often one would cook a meal for, you know, two or three, and or one would go round there to meal. And there were shops, small shops, on the way home from the aerodrome, so sometimes one would be able to get them from there, or one would get them in the morning before going in. There wasn't an awful lot to play about with at that time. We were all strictly rationed. And now, looking back on it, I can't think what we did make meals of, but we did. There was a hard at Hamble, and the Americans were manning that, you know, it was for small craft. And they had a PX, and of course unlimited supplies of all sorts of things that we were very short of. And on occasions, they would produce steak or something of the sort. And they would be far more than we could possibly eat because we were used to eating rather little then. And that, I mean, small quantities of that were very welcome, but if they were dining with you and required you to eat a whole thing, it was really too much.